This is for the tape. Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to thank Hans for inviting me, and thank you all for coming. I'll talk a little bit from my paper, and then I hope we'll have some discussion. One of the reasons I like to give talks is I'm usually very interested in hearing what everyone else has to say. And this looks like a very interesting group, so maybe we can talk about some of the ideas that I lay out. Hi. That's all right. Have a seat. Great. Let me explain the kind of work that I do on leadership to begin with. Leadership studies is a fairly new topic. It's an interdisciplinary topic. In 1991, I went to the University of Richmond. I used to teach at the Wharton School. And they had gotten $20 million to start the first school of leadership studies. And we are the only school of leadership studies in the world right now that gives a university degree in the subject. We look at leadership in all different areas. So we're interested in political leadership, business leadership, NGO leadership, church leadership, all areas of leadership we look at in our school. So my paper reflects our approach to leadership, which is looking at what is it that leaders do, what are some of the challenges and problems that leaders have, in particular, what kinds of ethical issues do leaders in all areas face. And from my point of view, the most important question we ask first is why is it difficult to be an ethical leader? Now, every time you read the newspaper, you may wonder about this, right? Because we have scandals and problems everywhere. And one of the things I start with in my paper is the findings of Transparency International, which, of course, is in Germany. And what's fascinating about that is every year I look at their studies, and I love to look at the map that they have. They have this beautiful map of the world that shows you in different colors which countries are the most corrupt and which ones the least corrupt. And it's absolutely fascinating. I have all sorts of theories that are completely unfounded about it. One of my theories is that for some reason, one year the map, the corrupt countries were dark red, and they were all around the middle of the globe. And then the pink countries were the most ethical ones, and they were up near the North Pole and the South Pole. So maybe something about cold weather and ethics. I haven't figured this out yet. But it's fascinating to look at that map because the Transparency International studies are interesting because they ask the question to the people in those countries of how they think about corruption. And so what that map means to me when I look at it is that if you look at the population of these countries that are in the middle, that seem to be the more corrupt ones, you discover that almost half of the people in the world seem to think that there are corrupt leaders in their society, whether in business and politics. And that's a very profound thought, isn't it, to think, well, there's an awful lot of them who aren't doing a good job. Of course, on the other hand, we know that we don't hear much about the ones who are doing a good job, but the good news is there's an awful lot of good leaders in society as well, and we're happy about that. So it's provocative to think about how important the ethics of leaders are in any kind of organization, whether it's a religious organization or an NGO, government, business, etc. Now, the interesting thing about leaders is the question, well, what happens to people when they become leaders? Now, we all know the old cliche, power corrupts, right? We've heard this over and over again. But it's a lot more than just power corrupts. Being a leader is a peculiar job. You're put in front of people. You're put above people. And you're put in a way, you have resources. You have temptations that ordinary people don't have. So there's a lot about being a leader that requires, I think, a special moral background and backbone. One of the things people say all the time is leaders should have a higher ethical standard than everyone else. And that's an odd thing to say because it would imply that everyone else could have lower ethical standards than their leaders, which would be a very sorry state of affairs to assume that anyone should be allowed to have lower ethical standards. When you look at scandals and the difficulties that leaders get themselves into, what you discover is it's not that they don't have higher ethical standards, But very often, leaders come to believe that they do not have to live by the same rules as everyone else. And this is a difficult problem. Leaders get in trouble when they don't pay their taxes. Well, everyone is required to pay their taxes. But leaders, for some reason, believe that they don't have to pay their taxes. Or they don't have to pay their parking tickets. Hans got a parking ticket today, so I'm bringing that up. Or that, you know, they don't have to follow the same rules as everyone else. Now, there's been some very interesting social science research into leaders' behaviors. And one fellow in America is a very well-known sociologist named Ed Hollander. He did a study of what's called the social interaction of leaders and followers. And what he discovered was that when people had a leader that they thought was doing a good job, they tended to give that leader a lot of latitude in what he or she did. So they gave them something which in English is called an idiosyncrasy credit. Now, the word idiosyncrasy in English means that you can act in a non-average or normal way. You can act in a different way. So when we think a leader's doing a good job, we allow them to innovate more, we trust them, we allow them to try new things, and these are all very positive parts of leadership. But the other difficulty is we often allow them to be special. And one of the problems that certainly in America is an enormous problem right now is that, for example, in corporations, we pay our corporate executives huge sums of money, outrageously large sums of money. And this, in my opinion, is a recipe for disaster in the long run because these people become so exceptional in terms of how much they make that they begin to think that they're different. And we've seen this in many of the big American business scandals down the line. I give one example in the paper of a fellow named Dennis Kozlowski. He was very famous. He was more famous for buying a $6,000 shower curtain than anything else, but he didn't pay taxes on paintings that he bought. He used his corporation's money for all sorts of personal things. And you look at someone like that and say, well, what does it take to make someone behave that way? Well, saying they're greedy really doesn't get at it. In his case, he had reached a point in terms of his own compensation and in terms of the amount of latitude people had given him that he began to think he was different than everyone else. So this is a very interesting issue for leaders, and that is we tend to honor our leaders. We give them special privileges. But the question is, what do these special privileges do to them? And to what extent do we need to be very, very careful about how we monitor the behavior of our leaders? Now, in other area of leadership research that people have looked at, they said, well, one of the things about being a leader is your job as a leader is to look after the interests of other people or organizations. So in business, if you're a business leader, you look after the interests of your business. If you're a political leader, the interests of your country. That's part of your job description. But it doesn't necessarily mean you have to be altruistic. Now, the word altruism in English, and I think it's pretty close in German, is the idea that you care for the interests of others, sometimes at your own expense. And good leaders frequently do that. They care for the interests of others at their own expense. But being altruistic doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be ethical. A suicide bomber can be very altruistic. They can sacrifice their life for a cause, but one might say that that's not necessarily ethical. So being a good leader is more than just looking after the interests of others. You have to do other things as well, that morality requires more than just that. Now, one of the things I find very interesting is the ancient literature on leadership, in particular the writings of Plato. In Plato's Republic, he makes this fascinating observation about leaders. It's a little bit depressing. In Plato's Republic, in the second book, he says that in a city of good men, and I'll read the quote, in the city of good men, it's in the paper, if it came into being, the citizens would fight in order not to rule. There it would be clear that anyone who is really a true ruler doesn't by nature seek his own advantage, but that of his subjects. And everyone knowing this would rather be benefited by others than take the trouble to benefit them. In other words, if you lived in a really good city with really good leaders, you would fight not to be a leader. Now, this is very depressing because part of what he's saying also is if you're an ethical person, you would not want to be a leader if other ethical people were running. Now, some people would stop there and say, well, that explains a lot, doesn't it? But his point, I think, is fascinating. First of all, have you ever noticed in your personal interactions that you feel a little bit uncomfortable with the person who wants to be the leader? The one who says, let me lead. That's usually the one you don't want to lead. So we have a funny kind of relationship with leaders because we worry, and this is what Plato's trying to get at that I think is so interesting. We worry about people who want to be leaders too much because we think they want to be leaders for themselves and not for everyone else. And what Plato realizes that to be a moral leader requires quite a bit from a person. It requires compromise. It requires many sleepless nights because an ethical leader worries. That's part of their job, is to worry. An ethical leader worries, and that it's not necessarily in your self-interest. But then he goes on and says something that's somewhat amusing. He goes on and says, well, okay, but so does this mean we can have no ethical leaders? And he says, no. He says, there's one thing that will make an ethical person want to be a leader. And that one thing, he says, is fear of punishment. And the punishment is fear of having someone worse than you become a leader. He said, that's what makes good men become leaders, is that fear that you'll get someone worse. So I think it's kind of an interesting insight into where we are in terms of leadership, that leadership is a difficult job. And I know, I don't know how it is in German politics, but one of the problems in America is that sometimes, in some parts of the country, it's difficult to even find people who want to run for public office. So as a result, the person who holds the position keeps getting reelected because sometimes there's no one who runs against them. Because politics can be extremely difficult. It takes a lot out of your personal life. We know in the modern world, especially with the media and the way in which the media gets involved in politicians' lives, you are sacrificing your privacy to be a politician. It can be a tough business. So people can actually be in Plato's position. And yet, at the same time, we also see that some marvelous people come along because they don't like what they see around them, and they run for office. And you know, we get the scenario where they would rather be in office than have someone worse than them in office. Now, the other interesting thing that we find about leadership as we look around the world is the fact that many people will say, well, aren't leaders born and not made? And one of the reasons people say that is that a lot of leaders are born, but not in the way in which we think. A lot of people are just born into families of leaders. So the other interesting question is leadership a family business? I give the example of the Bachs and the Bruegels. You know, the artists' families, right, where sons and grandsons go on. Certainly businesses run in families, we know that. But what about leadership? Well, we certainly know that the world history, we have kings, we have queens. But then we look at the modern day, and we look in the developing world, and one of the things that, you know, if you're an American or you're a Western European, you look at some of these countries and, you know, even a country like Egypt that's supposed to be a democracy, well, Mubarak is certainly planning on having his son take over if he has anything to do with it. Indonesia, we see leaders coming in who have relations down the line. And then, of course, nepotism has always been this paradox for leaders around the world. One of the most interesting philosophers in regard to nepotism is Confucius. If you read some of Confucius's writings, part of what Confucius talks about is the conflict of interest between the obligations you have to your family, in other words, to give your family jobs, and the obligations you have to the public. Because, of course, the Chinese always had a very rich civil service. And the paradox they had in their civil service was to how do you get the people who are qualified for the job to take the job. And Confucius has a lot of interesting things to say about this conflict. In particular, he was very, very interested in separating the two. How do you separate obligations to families? I mean, business people frequently have this problem. You go into certain countries and you hire a manager for, let's say, your factory, and the manager immediately wants to hire all of his relatives, right? And that can be a problem. You know, it depends on the family. Some families may be quite good. Other families may not be as good. But that's usually a problem. Some of the Chinese emperors, one of the reasons they had so many wives and concubines was because they had to make alliances with all of these different families, and that was a problem. In China, they used to use eunuchs in civil service because eunuchs didn't have children. In American history, one of the reasons the Americans liked George Washington so much for president was George Washington didn't have any sons. And Americans were very, very worried about nepotism in the Republic because, of course, they were getting rid of kings and queens, and they wanted to make sure that they had a true democracy. Thomas Jefferson ran against someone named John Adams. John Adams, in that political, and campaigns have always been very dirty in America, so you know they've always insulted each other. And one of the worries about John Adams and the reason why he lost to Jefferson was because he had a son. And Thomas Jefferson didn't have a son. Thomas Jefferson had daughters. And so in politics, the issue of nepotism has always been a very, very tricky one. On the other hand, in politics, you can also see that leadership can be a family business. People learn an awful lot about being leaders from the families they grow up in. If you remember back to when Corazon Aquino was president of the Philippines, and she ran a rather extraordinary revolution. Her famous people power revolution was, you know, a peaceful overthrow of Marcos. That was an extraordinary thing to do. And when she was running for president, she kept saying, "But I'm just a housewife," right? She's a housewife who grew up in a family where her father was a leader and her husband was a major political leader. So her house was actually a leadership school in a way. And all of these sensibilities came out. So I think it's a fascinating paradox. My favorite quote from the Chinese on nepotism. I think there's some. Is there a seat back there? Here. My favorite quote from the Chinese about nepotism is this: when a man becomes an official, his wife, children, dogs, cats, and even chickens fly up to heaven. So if you get a good job, you can get all of your relatives a good job. What's fascinating in American politics today, since the 2000 election, is we have more relatives of politicians in government than ever before. When George Bush became president, and of course the son of a former president, all sorts of people's wives and children got high-level government jobs. What's very interesting, you know, you've probably been following the scandal with the World Bank and Paul Wolfowitz. Paul Wolfowitz's girlfriend, who caused all this trouble, is now, her boss is now Dick Cheney's daughter. Think about that. Anton Scalia of the Supreme Court, his son became a high-level government official. Cheney's daughter and her husband both got high-level jobs in the State Department. The list goes on and on. It's absolutely fascinating how nepotism has grown in American government. And, of course, it raises all the questions of, you know, are all the most competent people running the government or not? And we won't even get into that question today. Anyway, so other interesting things about families and leadership that get to some, because certainly nepotism raises the ethical question of competence, is if we look at British prime ministers, there have been some very preliminary studies that have found that very often leaders are people who have lost one or both of their parents when they were young. In one study of British prime ministers, 60% of British prime ministers had lost a parent as a child. Now, there are all sorts of interesting psychological speculation about this. One psychologist named Howard Gardner has said that one of the things that happens when people are orphaned is they take on greater responsibilities, but they also become more skilled at building social relationships, which is one of the key skills of leadership. So ever since I've heard this, and maybe now that you've heard it, you'll start noticing which leaders have lost parents as children. I mean, it's interesting to go back and In American presidents, there's a whole lot of them, and some of our best presidents have lost parents as children. Lincoln, Jefferson, certainly Bill Clinton lost one, Roosevelt did, and you can go down the line. So it's rather extraordinary to see where leadership comes from in families there. The other positive side of leadership in families is that families are what help women become leaders. And if you look around the world today, now about 6% of heads of state are women. Very often they get into office because of husbands, grandfathers, fathers, or other relatives who have sort of set the stage for name recognition, et cetera. And in American politics, it's really striking. It's extraordinary how many women in the American political system, in the House and in the Senate, and certainly Hillary Clinton, have been involved in politics that have family relations involved in politics. Nancy Pelosi, who is our first Speaker of the House, her father was the mayor of Baltimore, so she has even more fascinating, including your head of state, are women who get into politics and achieve high positions who don't have family in leadership, and those are probably, Margaret Thatcher is another one, who are especially extraordinary, or are not parts of elites, because then you go to other countries where you have sort of aristocracies, and that's a different story as well. So some of these issues that I'm trying to lay out, when we look at leaders, there's a very broad framework for thinking about ethics, and that is the kind of tension between the ethics of the leader and their competency. And the interesting and fascinating interrelation of these is that sometimes there's a question of whether a leader who is incompetent, not good at doing the leader's job, is unethical because they are incompetent. And we separate the two. I mean, a lot of people in politics will say, well, you have to do whatever you can to get elected. And in some parts of the world, it's rather striking. Now, I want to be a reformer, but I have to bribe people to win the election so that I can be a reformer. Well, that doesn't usually work too well, but there's some seats over here. That doesn't usually work too well, but it's an interesting interrelationship. So the challenge of leadership is not just the job itself and the way people treat leaders and how you become a leader, because how you become a leader is very important, but it's also having the skills. And when we designed our leadership school, for example, part of what we were looking at is how do you create a situation where you cultivate in our students the desire to take on the moral responsibilities of leaders and at the same time the appropriate skills for being able to do that in an effective way. Every person who goes into business knows, and when I used to teach business students, I would say, well, you know, you don't need to go to business school to become a thief or a crook. Well, maybe you could become a better crook, but it depends on which business school you go to. But the challenge of business, of course, is how to do it, following the law, taking care of society, et cetera. So I think these are some of the tension that we find. One last issue I wanted to bring up. Very often when we talk about bad leaders, we often talk about political leaders or business leaders, but bad leaders are everywhere. They're very egalitarian. They show up in NGOs. They show up in religious organizations. Bad leaders can be any place. And there's another phenomena that often leads leaders to get into trouble, and that is that sometimes leaders believe that they're so moral, they're so ethical, they're so right, that they don't have to follow the rules. And I call this blinding morality, that sometimes people are blinded by their morality. So we often think about them having not enough morality. They run into problems when they have too much as well. And this is an interesting phenomenon that we've seen, certainly in America, in the Catholic Church scandals. A lot of priests did not take the appropriate measures when they discovered that other priests were molesting young children. In any society, this is the worst crime you could possibly commit. But in the American church, a lot of people didn't treat it that way. They somehow felt that, you know, they're the good people. They're the church. We're the good ones. So if we're the good ones, then we're an exception. We can treat this problem in a different way. And that's an extremely dangerous mentality. We find it with organizations like soup kitchens that feed the poor people. We feed the poor people, so we don't have to have the same health standards as the restaurants do. We don't have to wear the hairnets, and we don't have to have the plastic gloves on. So often people think when they're doing good that they don't have to follow the same rules. Mother Teresa, now this is, it's terrible to say anything bad about Mother Teresa, but one of the criticisms of Mother Teresa's organization in India was that they weren't following appropriate health practices in their organization. And of course, again, you know, this is nothing against Mother Teresa, but the point is that even if you're doing really good things, it doesn't mean that you don't have to follow the same standards. So leaders get into trouble in that respect too. So lastly, I want to just leave you with a little story. It's always good to leave with a story. One of the other thing that happens is when people think that they are so good that they don't have to follow the rules, they often forget what they know. They forget what they really understand. So the last little story I wanted to leave you with is the story of Magellan, the famous explorer. And as you know, Magellan went to the king and queen of Spain with this big idea, and his big idea was that he thought that the Rio River went all the way across South America. And so he got money from them, and he took out his ships, and he was going to take them all the way across, and they'd have this marvelous new route to take. And of course, he got to the Rio River, and they got to the end, and it didn't go across. So he had a very difficult leadership problem right there. And then he did this extraordinary thing. Can you imagine? You have three ships of men who have been out at sea, and they think they're going to get across the South American continent, and they discover they're not. He convinced them to go all the way down and around South America, down the Tierra del Fuego, and all the way up 12,000 miles to the Philippines. An amazing navigational feat. A brilliant sailor. Brilliant tacticianer, and a brilliant leader. All at once. When he got to the Philippines, he decided he had a new job. His job was to convert all of the Filipinos to Christianity, as the Spanish did. And he started doing it with the same kind of energy and excitement that he had. He began to think he could cure people by praying over them. And eventually, he decided he needed to do something big to finally convince them that Christianity is superior to everything else. And what he decided to do was he decided to stage a battle against an unconverted chief. And he was going to stage the battle so people could watch, because you know the Philippines is a lot of little islands. Now the interesting thing about this battle is that none of his men wanted to take part in it. None of them that knew how to fight wanted to take part. So he went to battle with cooks and people who normally don't fight battles. And the day of the battle came, and it was a very simple plan for this battle. The plan of the battle was that they were going to go ashore in these very small boats, and you've got to imagine they have these conquistador outfits on, you know. And the boats were going to take them to shore, and then the big ships were going to come in behind them with their big guns, and, you know, they'd start fighting the guys, but then the guns were just going to blow these guys up, you know, with the cannons. So that was going to be the superiority he wanted to show. The day of the battle came. They got in the small boats. They approached the shore. They got closer and closer. Magellan must have looked over his shoulder, and there were no ships. And Magellan, the greatest navigator in the world, had made a big mistake. He forgot to ask about the tides. And his ships were stranded outside the reef. Magellan was cut down, killed in this battle, in the water, because he forgot to ask about the tides. And it's a wonderful example of a kind of mistake that when we look at history, we see leaders make sometimes. And that is that they get all of their energy, they believe that they're so right, and they forget everything, whether it's about history, whether they forget it's about technical things like the tides, and they move ahead. And I think this is an interesting kind of lesson for the elements that are fundamental to leadership and morality. And these elements are things like self-knowledge, the kinds of checks and balances of people around them. How do you keep leaders in the right perspective? How do we keep them from giving them so many privileges that they think they're different than the rest of us? Because that's an important realization, and even Plato eventually comes to this, that leaders are the same as the rest of us. They're highly fallible human beings who are put in this extraordinary position, And our job is to make sure that they do their jobs well. And I think one of the tricky things is how do we do this, whether it's in an organization, whether it's in a society itself. And then, very often, how do we keep them mindful of what they know? How do we keep them remembering what they know? I mean, the irony of Magellan's story is, of course, over 80% of the Philippines is Catholic. So he obviously did his job well. He lost his life for it, but he at least did his job well. but he forgot what he knew. And leaders very often forget what they know. And I think part of the what we aim for, whether as educators or as people in organizations, is how do we keep leaders mindful of these things? One last point. There's a marvelous book called Reverence by a philosopher named Paul Woodruff. He's a classicist and a philosopher. And in the ancient times, in both the writings of people like Confucius and Lao Tzu, and in the writings of the ancient Greeks and some of the ancient Romans, there's a virtue called reverence. And reverence is the virtue for leaders. And I'll just read to you what it is. It says, reverence begins with a deep understanding of human limitations. From this grows a capacity to be in awe of whatever we believe lies outside of our control: God, truth, justice, nature, even death. The capacity for awe, as it grows, brings with it the capacity for respecting fellow human beings, flaws and all. This in turn fosters the ability to be ashamed when we show moral flaws exceeding the normal allotment. So in other words, one of the things that the ancients said about leaders is they needed reverence, because reverence was the virtue that kept leaders from thinking they were gods. And so with that point, I'll just stop and take comments and questions. Thank you.